Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On December 14th, 1992, Gregory Gibson's son, Galen, was shot and killed at his school, Bard College at Simon's Rock in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The shooter was an 18-year-old fellow student who randomly fired at people with an SKS semi-automatic rifle loaded with ammunition he'd ordered over the phone. At the time, the shooter said he was receiving commands from God. In the 25 years since, Greg Gibson has tried to understand both why and how his son's life was so easily cut short that day. He's even exchanged letters with his son's killer, who's currently serving two life sentences. Then, earlier this month, in an extraordinary StoryCorps conversation, we heard this.
My name is Greg Gibson, and I'm speaking with the man who killed my son.
My name is Wayne Lowe. I'm sitting here with the father of Galen, whom I murdered 25 years ago.
As StoryCorps says, Gibson was not looking to forgive or to find closure. But nevertheless, it was the first time Gregory Gibson and Wayne Lowe met face to face. And Gregory Gibson joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Nice to be here.
Can I just first ask you the obvious question? I mean, why is it that you decided to have a face-to-face conversation with the person who killed your son?
Wayne Lowe, the man who murdered my son, and I have been corresponding for 20 years, and we've agreed throughout the course of that correspondence to use our stories to try to ensure that no one else has to go through what we obviously have gone through. About 3 years ago, I had the idea to take that conversation and make a commercial out of it, make a public service announcement. But I could get no traction until StoryCorps came along. And the question lingering over that whole conversation is, what is this guy doing? You know, why is he doing this? Survivors of the Simon's Rock shooting in which my son was killed were mortally offended and deeply injured that this killer, his voice, that he was given prominence, that he was given a voice, that he was given a public place. And then, you know, just the general public, so many people came up to me and said, I cried all the way into work, you know, and I felt terrible. All these people crying. What if there were traffic accidents as a result of tears? I mean, I felt like saying, but I never did. Thank you so much. I appreciate your feeling, but I don't want your tears. I want you to jump up and call 10 Republican senators and tell them not to pass this stupid concealed carry reciprocity bill or things of that nature. Yeah.
So can I ask you just a little bit more? So the StoryCorps conversation is the only one that you had with Lowe. But how long? We heard about 5 minutes of it. How long did you actually talk with him?
I think it was about a little over an hour.
There's a lot that we didn't hear.
You bet, yeah. Wayne walks in the door. I mean, we've never seen each other face-to-face since a criminal trial. He walks in the door, takes one look at me, and bursts into tears. Now, of all the reactions that, in all the scenarios I played through my head before this event, that was the last thing. I mean, I just didn't expect it. And, you know, the rest of that hour, a great deal of that hour, was the theme.
Since you mentioned that how much we heard was dominated by Lowe's own tears, I just want to play a little couple of seconds from your StoryCorps conversation because there's a very specific question I have about a particular moment from it. And so this is from the middle of the conversation, and Wayne Lowe is talking about the fact that he never personally knew Galen, your son, but had seen him on campus.
I didn't know Galen personally at Simon's Rock, but at the trial, you spoke about how you guys came on campus that time and came out of the car and everybody gave Galen a standing ovation. I was there. I was there, Mr. Gibson. I was there. I didn't know him, but I stood up to him because I knew everybody loved him.
Well, we sure did.
Greg Gibson, of all the possible things that you could have said to Wayne Lowe in that moment, you chose empathy above all. I mean, what else did you want to say to him?
Well, geez, I don't know. You know, it wasn't a choice. I mean, this is stuff our family has been working through for 25 years. And after that amount of time, I think this stuff is just, it's part of who you are. You know, this stuff just comes out. I mean, isn't that what empathy is? It just, it's just what comes out of you.
Well, and then what came out of you right after that is you tell Wayne Lowe, this is sure exhausting, isn't it? I mean, that's the voice of a father.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's kind of weird, isn't it? I mean, you never want to get tricked or trapped into the feeling that somehow I've swapped Galen for this kid. There's no way in the world that I feel like he's has any relationship to me. He's the guy who killed my son, and that's the relationship. But you still, you know, he's another human being. He's struggling. God, I can't imagine, you know, what somebody like that lives with.
Yeah, but
day after
but
day.
But I mean, but what about you, Greg? I mean, you're living with it too.
Ah, yeah. Well, you know, listen, I've devoted my energy and my life to trying to salvage some useful thing from this horrendous, stupid waste. You know, that's been it from day one.
5 years ago, after the Sandy Hook shooting, I called you because you had written an op-ed in the New York Times, and I asked if you'd be willing to talk with us. I called you on a weekend, and you spoke with me over the phone, not on the air, but over the phone very graciously, and you kindly declined. The way I remember it, you were angry that this had happened again, disgusted, and just, I remember you ended up reading your New York Times op-ed to us on the air, which was the most that you wanted to do at that moment, because, I mean, you had told me that you just, that people only come to you after these mass shootings, and in the long run, you're not sure if anyone actually cares because we're not doing what we need to do to change this. I mean, do you still feel that way? Do you still feel that in the long run, America just doesn't care?
Boy, you know, Chester Himes, the great writer, after the people, the white guys who had tortured and murdered Emmett Till for whistling at a white woman, after they were acquitted of their crime, Chester Himes said, you know, the worst thing about this whole situation is when people realize that if they wanted to, they could stop it. Mm-hmm. And they're not stopping it. You know, if I have anger, if I have confusion, if I have anything, it's just for that reason. This killing, these murders, this constant stream of suffering is something that we could do things to stop. There's 300 million guns out there. Are we going to stop it completely? No, I don't think so. But we can change this culture. We can change this shoulder shrug where, oh, God, you know, it's awful, but we can't help it.
Yeah.
Just think about all these mass shootings. They're like, this is like reality TV for us. This is a consumer product now. It's terrible.
Yeah. You know, what you wrote in the New York Times 5 years ago, I'm summarizing it. I mean, you basically said that dead children are the price that America pays for our high tolerance for mass violence and for gun violence. And
sure.
Greg Gibson, if I could just say, if you said to me right now, you don't think that America really cares, I wouldn't blame you at all, because I'm thinking, even in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, when a man opened fire using what was essentially a weapon converted to fire like an automatic weapon, shot more than 500 people, the United States Congress still could not pass any legislation around maybe making these sort of this equipment harder to get. And the only thing that the House was able to pass is actually going to make it easier for people to carry concealed weapons across state lines. I mean, what? Yeah, maybe America doesn't care about dead children.
I think you're channeling Greg Gibson, or maybe I'm channeling you. Yeah, what person in his right mind would find that a normal, sensible reaction to this kind of slaughter? So, yeah, we've got to change something. I mean, we've got to get cowards out of Congress. We've got to get people in there who understand that sensible gun laws can save lives. But, you know, it's not going to be all just legislation. Years ago, I went into Boston and talked to one of my old-time colleagues and comrades, Tina Sherry, whose son was killed just a year after Galen,
right,
again on the streets of Dorchester rather than a college campus. And she started the Lewis D. Brown Peace Institute. I could never quite figure out what they were up to because they didn't seem as politically active as I thought they ought to be. And I went in there and she said, you know, this moment of violence is what all the shouting is about, but that's not where we work, because there's all this time before that moment and all this time after that moment. And that's where we work, all the time before and all the time after. How did it get to murder? How do we make this anything but a dysfunctional, vengeful, broken community? And I realized advocacy isn't enough. Legislation isn't enough. When we had the AIDS crisis, when we were thinking about, remember the cancer, what cancer was like in my parents' generation. It was something scary. It was something that was everywhere, and we didn't want to talk about it. And we fantasized about a cure for cancer that became like a, you know, like just a saying sort of. And look what we've done. We've treated AIDS, and we've treated cancer, and we've treated so many of these other things with a whole barrage of therapies. And I think ultimately, you know, if we're ever going to get out of this horrible nightmare of gun violence, that's how we're going to do it.
Some folks listening might say, you know, we do have some evidence, though, that states that have tighter gun control laws, mass gun violence is lower in those states than others. So isn't there room to push for more laws on where these weapons come from and who uses them?
Oh, I believe so, completely. Yeah. I mean, there's no coincidence between the fact that Massachusetts has some of the most stringent gun laws in the country, and it also has the lowest murder rate in the country. Gee, is that a coincidence or not? You know, I think there is stuff we can do to legislate. But let's go back again. You know, 300 million guns, Megha, out there with shelf lives of decades, if not hundreds of years. They're not going to go away. So we need more than just good laws. We desperately need good laws. That's why I'm still working for Every Town and Moms Demand Action. People like groups like that that are out there doing things, getting things done. But it's not going to be just laws alone that solve this problem.
Yeah.
We're sick. We're sick as a country.
So let me ask you about that, because you've had to think about this for 25 years now. And look, I take your point that laws aren't going to be the ultimate solution. But I feel like there's something that, like, we as a nation, maybe it's the sickness that you're talking about, that we're just not grappling with enough, right? That we haven't faced enough.
Mm.
What is that thing?
You know, one of the survivors in the course of my activity said to me about a month ago, she says, people always come up to me and they say, I can't imagine what you're going through. And she says, and then I think to myself, well, maybe you should try to imagine what I'm going through, because if you really could imagine it, you might get up and do something about it. You know, in Newtown, I remember they sent teddy bears. They sent truckloads of teddy bears. Newtown had to rent storage space to store these teddy bears. And it's like, oh, God's sakes, why don't you vote for universal background checks or magazine size limits? And no, I think I'd rather send a teddy bear. You know, it's just that kind of thing that we just, I have no answer for the question that you ask. How do we miss that piece? What's wrong with us? Yeah.
Yeah. It's not fair of me to ask you that a question like that, because, you know, this is something that we as an entire nation need to be thinking about. Like, what are we missing?
Mm-hmm.
What are we not talking about?
But, yeah, what are we not talking about here?
But you've been put in this position of being, you know, a member of a terrible, you know, I don't want to call it a club, but a group of people who have found themselves in a place that they never wanted to be.
We call it a club. We
call
it the
club
nobody wants to join.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I remember in the StoryCorps conversation, again, with Lo, the person who killed your son, you talked about how, you know, that your family is proud every day that you are working for Galen, but that also that people don't want to have to keep doing this, the this being, you know, talking about the latest shooting.
But or the difficult emotional work of just I mean, it's in a horrible way, it's easier for survivors. And who am I to talk? I mean, it's something we think about every day because we know what it is. But you, if you're just a regular, normal person, you don't want to think about that. You can't imagine it. And you don't want to put yourself there. It's the last place you want to go. But every person who's killed, there must be 10 or a dozen people around them that are profoundly affected. And every year there's 30,000 people killed and 100,000 injured. And how much longer do we have to go until the majority of people in America are survivors? Is that really what it's going to take for this thing to turn? Maybe it is. You know, they talk about, yeah, my grandson is like crazy about this zombie apocalypse. Well, maybe things aren't going to turn around until we have a survivor apocalypse. Is it going to really have to get that bad? I don't know.
You know, we're coming up on the anniversary of the actual day of your son's death. What do you do on that day? How do you remember him?
Well, actually what we do is the family goes down to the graveyard, which is right down the street here, and we have a little Christmas tree business that we run. We sell Christmas trees over the holiday. And so we take a little Charlie Brown Christmas tree down to the grave and set it up on the grave. You know, it's my wife and me and my daughters and sons-in-laws and relatives and grandchildren, and we set the tree up and put some decorations around it, and the kids run around. And it's actually something that we can do as a family, including Galen. So it's a rich and nuanced affair and not at all the sad, melancholy thing that you might expect it to be.
Yeah. Can I ask you just one more question?
Sure.
I'm looking at a picture of Galen right now. It's a black and white photograph of him, and he's just looking directly at the camera, but looking directly at me since I'm looking at this picture, and he's got these intense eyes that just, you know, there's a little mischief in there. There's kindness. There's a sense of, I feel like there's a lot that he knows in this picture. It just makes me want to tell me more about him. I mean, is there a story about him that really encapsulates the person he was?
You know, I think he was a wise and deep person. When he was young, he was so different than other kids. I think he suffered enormously socially, really. He couldn't figure out where he fit in. I remember times talking to him in fifth and sixth grade, and it all seemed so black. It all seemed nobody understood, and he didn't know. And, you know, I mean, he went through all this stuff, and somehow, on the other side of puberty, he had learned, because he had just this lovely mind. This, you know, it was so good in so many directions. He was so quick. He could so improvise. So, I think he really learned from his own experiences in life. And yeah, by the time he was 18, you know, in his last years, he was this enormously empathetic human being, really smart about people, really understanding of people, really patient with people. In a way, you know, he's sort of my inspiration for all of this, because at the time he died, he was really pretty advanced in those terms. You know, you think, geez, what would he have, where would we be today? Well, I don't know, but I think it would have been a pretty good place.
Yeah. Well, Gregory Gibson's son, Galen, was killed 25 years ago at a shooting at Simon's Rock College. Gregory's also author of Gone Boy, A Father's Search for the Truth in His Son's Murder. Greg Gibson, it's been a real privilege to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about this, Meghna. It's so something that needs to get talked about a lot, and I really appreciate you giving it a little time here.
We've got a long ways to go.
So. Got a long way to go.
And we've got links to Greg's writing in the New York Times and that StoryCorps conversation he had with the Simon's Rock shooter. You can find all of that at radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.